Good evening, everyone. Welcome, friends. As I've said several times in the past, we need to stick together. So thank you for joining with us on a Monday evening. I was going to talk about tonight's topic yesterday, but a few things came up. Topic, and someone said in band, they were saying it sounds like we might be talking about the BTFP, the Bank Term Funding Program, and yes, indeed we are. Sorry, I look a little rough around the edges. I didn't shave today. I apologize. I guess it's just part of living on a farm, right? At any rate, Bank Term Funding Program. I would like to start off tonight by reading a fairy tale. This is from the Federal Reserve Board. The Bank Term Funding Program, BTFP, was created to support American businesses and households by making additional funding available to eligible depository institutions to help assure banks have the ability to meet the needs of all their depositors. The Bank Term Funding Program offers loans of up to 1 year in length to banks, savings associations, credit unions, and other eligible depository institutions, pledging any collateral eligible for purchase by the Federal Reserve banks in open market operations, such as U.S. Treasuries, U.S. Agency Securities, and U.S. Agency Mortgage-Backed Securities. These assets will be valued at par. The BTFP is an additional source of liquidity against high-quality securities, eliminating an institution's need to quickly sell those securities in times of stress. Well, that's the fairy tale that we're going to take apart tonight, and I'll be referring back to the Federal Reserve's own website here to take apart this and highlight this very short paragraph, which has major implications for not only the U.S. economy, but the global economy as a whole. I'm not saying the sky is falling. Today is the 11th of March, and as you all know, we talked about this a couple of weeks ago, that today was the date that this program was due to end, and it did end. We've not heard from the Fed as to a replacement program, if there's even one in the works, but we're going to presume that there is not a replacement program. And therefore, what I anticipate to be the ramifications of the ending of the Bank Term Funding Program. Of course, I'll define it and review the background and context for you. But what does it mean to you and I up front? In short, this should result, and again, there's no way of predicting with any degree of, you know, high degree of certainty here or anything like that. It's just looking at the trend, looking at the pattern, looking at history, but looking at the situation with regard to finances here in the U.S. that also speaks to the finances of the world as a whole. What it means to you and I is that banks will have less money to lend. This is a form of liquidity. Money that's available to lend to borrowers is one form of liquidity. This means that the criteria for lending, the lending criteria, the qualifications that you and I would have to meet in order to obtain a loan, and the cost of that, the interest, would be higher. So this describes a credit crisis. This describes the drying up of the available money for lending for banks. This is the bread and butter of the banks, making loans, among other things. If they're unable to make loans, then that puts the bank in a liquidity crisis. In a more specific example or definition of their liquidity crisis, it puts them in a income crisis. They have a limited source of income if they're not making loans. Doug, I'm noting that the stream seems to be buffering here tonight for some reason. Let me check with band. Folks in band, if you can let me know if this is buffering. David said in band he thought we would be talking about the BTFP, and he is correct. No, Doug, I haven't rebooted lately. Sorry, we got a little technical glitch going on here. Anyway, we'll proceed. The cash flow crisis of the bank, the liquidity crisis for you and I, the availability, okay, Doug, thanks. The availability of loans translates to a slowdown in the business sector, a slowing down in our ability to purchase a home, an automobile, to obtain credit cards. Okay, we'll try to keep going here. Let me check in band one more time. I apologize. Yes, here. Okay. At any rate, let me see if I can continue. For the banks, what the Bank Term Funding Program, BTFP, represented was a short-term influx of available money from the Federal Reserve. This was to keep the banks afloat. That's all it is. The banks are insolvent. The U.S. government is insolvent. European Central Bank is insolvent. So this is just kicking the can down the road. What the banks did with the money was to loan it out. Now they're not able to do that. What are the banks going to do? If it results in tighter lending criteria, if it results in charging higher interest rates, and that's on the consumer side, the borrower side, that makes for the banks things even more difficult because the result will be fewer. Fewer qualified borrowers means fewer customers. Now that's pretty straightforward. We're going to get into, you know, the weeds here. We're going to drill down and get deeper into this topic. The reason I'm saying this is because as these banks experience more and more difficulty in the coming weeks and months, they're going to be purchased by the larger banks. This is the consolidation process that we've been talking about for over a year now. But the central issue of liquidity is still there. If the bank are these depositors, these depository institutions, where do they get the money to lend out? Well, there is a program that has been around for a few years that's known as the reverse repo market. And again, this is from the Federal Reserve. Now we have the BTFP that expired today. The reverse repo program, in right around the end of May, early June, is going to run out of money. It's not that the reverse repo program, which is a short-term lending program to the banks, it's a buyback program. It's in its funding. At its peak, not long ago, the reverse repo fund program, if you want to call it that, that was available to banks for short-term borrowing, at its peak had about $2.5 trillion in its fund. And I'm calling it a fund just to simplify the matter. Right now, it's dwindled dramatically from $2.5 trillion down to $450 billion. That $450 billion will run its course. It will be used, bringing the reverse repo program down to zero in late May, early June of this year. So we have Sorry, when I see my screen here buffering, I pause just in case you're not able to see and hear me. At any rate, we have two significant expiration dates today and May or June for really what makes up the core of what the Federal Reserve is all about with respect to the banks, because the Federal Reserve was set up for the benefit of banks. That's why I called this Federal Reserve statement about the BTFP a fairy tale. It was created to support American businesses and households by making additional funding available to eligible depository institutions, the ability to meet the needs of their depositors. So we would read that and say, oh, well, that's so that the banks, in case they experience an abnormally large demand by depositors for their money, leading to perhaps a bank run, if there was a surge in cash by depositors, then there was the ability for the bank, short term, to go to the Fed and borrow that money to meet that demand placed by their depositors. That's how we would interpret it. And in a healthy banking environment, that would be the case. And you and I intuitively would say that kind of makes sense. If there was a big demand for a product by a retailer, that retailer would try to get more of that product to meet that demand. A bank is no different than going to Walmart, okay? So that's the surface explanation. The deeper explanation is the lack of reserves on the part of the bank. And the fact that the banks are operating from the standpoint of being inherently insolvent. You know, in the biological and the viral discussions, we talk about an endemic disease, that a disease moves from being a pandemic to an embedded disease constantly within a population, so it's endemic. The banks are endemically insolvent. It's just the normal state of the banks and has been for many years. when we here in the U.S. that had a ripple effect across the globe, but here in the U.S. we experienced the great financial crisis of 08 and 09. To help the banks and help the economy recover, the Federal Reserve offered 0% interest money, 0% interest on money lent by the Federal Reserve to banks. At the same time, they eliminated the requirement for the banks to hold any reserves, any capital, any assets in reserve. And again, reserves to meet depositor demands, to meet any sort of catastrophic economic occurrence. This is where you hear about the stress testing of banks. Well, that all went away. No reserves, free money, and that continued really when the pandemic hit. And again, in the pandemic, there was in 2020 the push by the federal government to give money to individual American citizens. $1,400 a month, that type of thing. There were two or three payments that went out to individuals. So free money, but that had to come from somewhere. And again, zero on money from the Fed on the part of banks borrowing. Now we're at about 5.3, 5.4% interest. And that's the cost of money from the Federal Reserve to a bank. And then a bank will add about 2 to 3% as their best rate for their best customers, 2 to 3% on top of that. So 7 to 8% for a person with good credit. That spiking of the interest rates ostensibly on the part of the Fed was for the purpose of controlling and reducing, bringing down inflation. It really doesn't have anything to do with inflation. Inflation is driven more by government deficit spending and the printing of money by the Fed, the artificial increase in the money supply. This is what really is at the core, the monetary base of inflation. Now, there is discussion on the part of the Fed, perhaps, at their March meeting, beginning to reduce. Last meeting, they paused. They didn't increase in the interest rate. Now they're talking about perhaps starting to cut back the interest rate to reduce it. That's not altogether a good thing, the Fed reducing their interest rates. And you'll appreciate that as I get further on into the details tonight. But the short answer to the impact of the Fed reducing interest, it's not necessarily a good thing, although you might think lowering the interest rate would be good for borrowers. It has to do with where institutional investors, big money investors, private investors as well as institutions, where they're putting their money, where they are parking their cash. You've heard me talk about the Federal Reserve, or I should say the Treasury notes and the bonds, historically regarded as a safe haven because the bonds are backed by the U.S. The full faith and credit in the U.S. government in its ability to not only make the interest payments, the yield on the bond, but to pay back the bond at its time of maturity. Full faith and credit. So parking your extra cash in bonds was a safe haven. But then you have to look at the yield, the interest rate on the bonds, and how that compares to money market funds, as an example, or the rate of return if you're speculating in the stock market. This can get very complex very quickly, so I'm trying to keep it on a straight track here for us. So let's stay on the Bank Term Funding Program for I keep losing my image, the camera image. Doug, are you seeing buffering at your end? Is the stream actually buffering? Or are we just losing my picture and the audio's remaining? If the audio's remaining, I'll just keep speaking through the video feed. Yeah, okay, he says it's dropping. I apologize, folks. I'm not going to stop the stream and restart it. That just becomes too problematic. So we'll just try to go through. Every time I lose the visual, I'll pause, okay? Okay, thanks, Doug. So BTFP, I want to define the title tonight, monetary base. So the monetary base of the economy, and yes, I'm speaking from the United States, but pretty much this holds true in the Western nations, in what are considered the advanced economies of the world. So the monetary base is formed of the minted coins, the printed currency, and from our Federal Reserve, our central bank, credit, okay? So those are the building blocks from which banks then are able to issue loans. This is the basis for all liquidity, money supply, okay? So the printed money, the minted money, and the availability of credit from the Federal Reserve. Remember, they set monetary policy. That means the availability of credit to the banks, who then turn around and lend it. With the third component, credit, at risk now, from the perspective of the banks, credit, the availability of credit from the Fed being put at risk, that means that there will be a direct impact on us, as I said, if we're trying to get a loan, trying to get a credit card. But businesses, let's say you're a manufacturer and you take an order, a significantly large order, that's going to necessitate perhaps hiring more people, buying more material, more supplies from subcontractors that are making components for you that you then bring to your factory, to your manufacturing site. So based upon a large order coming in, a company can go to a bank and take out a loan, a short-term loan, to meet those needs, to be able to buy material, hire people, perhaps purchase additional capital equipment in order to meet that order. The order becomes the collateral, okay? So that has an impact on businesses, and let's talk about hiring or laying off. The lack of credit to a business translates to laying people off. Then that has an obvious ripple effect upon the economy. Let's talk about the housing sector. If a person doesn't have a source of income, they cannot qualify for a loan. If there is a lack of liquidity, if there's a lack of the ability for the bank to even write a mortgage, the housing market declines rapidly. As it declines, the existing homes, both residential and commercial properties, including rental properties as a residence, they, in their market value, decline. Outside of a lending cycle, a lending discussion, the market value of real estate begins to collapse. So I'm painting a picture of a debt-based economy whose lifeblood is the availability of credit. Now, let's go back to the Federal Reserve reducing interest rates. You would think that that would be a positive. Money market funds, as an institutional investor, a money market fund, a money market manager, a company that is managing depositor investor monies, and it is placed in a money market fund, and that fund is itself turned over to the Federal Reserve and put on the Fed Reserve books, their accounting books. In other words, a money market fund manager would be loaning his or her client's money to the Federal Reserve. In return, they're receiving interest payments from the Federal Reserve. Now, when the interest rates are higher, then those money market lenders, money market fund lenders to the Fed, are receiving a higher return. It's also equal, for the sake of discussion, to the discussion or the notion of a safe haven. Federal Reserve, it's not federal government, it's not U.S. government, full faith and credit of the government in the discussion of bonds and T-bills. No, it's full faith in the Federal Reserve, or private banking organization, that the money market fund manager is putting their faith in the Fed to be able to continue to pay the interest, a higher interest, and be able to return the principal, the money that was lent to the Fed. The comparison of interest rates is this. You have the Federal Reserve over here, and they're offering money markets, let's just say it's the going rate, 5.5%. While over here, Treasury is offering, let's say on a 10-year note, and let me just get my notes for my 10-year rate is 4-something. Let me find it real quick. Today's right here. Yeah. Today, the 10-year yield is 4.07%. It's been dropping, the 10-year. This is the inverted yield. I'll come back to that in a minute, but I just wanted to say, in comparison, if Treasury is saying 4%, just to round the numbers off, and Fed is saying, we'll pay you 5%, where would that money market fund manager place his or her client's money? It would be with the Fed, because there's a higher interest rate, for this example, 1% higher interest. So there's a higher rate of return from the Fed. So that diverts money away from the Treasury, and that creates a problem. So let's go back to the Fed, where they're paying 1% more than Treasury. And now the Fed says, well, we're going to drop from 5%, and let's say it goes to 4.75%. Now you've got a money market fund manager who's saying, well, what's Treasury offering? With this lowering by Fed, what's Treasury? What's the yield over here? Well, today the yield is going down over at Treasury. And in the foreseeable future, it does not appear that the Treasury is going to raise their yield, their interest payments. It appears for 8 months now, the Treasury yield between the 2-year and the 10-year has been inverted, which means the longer term, the 10-year interest that's being paid is lower than the interest being paid on the 2-year Treasury note. This is the second longest period of inversion that has ever been experienced in U.S. history. And in 2 months' time, it will be the longest period in U.S. history that the 2-year versus the 10-year has been inverted. Normally, a 2-year, because it's a short-term note, will pay a lower interest rate than a longer-term note, a 10-year. The normal scenario is, if you are willing to park your money for 10 years with the Treasury, we'll make that very attractive by paying you more interest than the interest you would receive if you only parked it at Treasury for 2 years. Now that's upside down. The 2-year is paying more than the 10-year. So why would people park money in the 10-year? So let's go back to our money market example. Money market says, okay, the 2-year over at Treasury, how does that compare to what the Federal Reserve is paying? Well, it may be very close to being equal. The problem at Treasury is that they're on the downward trend in what they're willing to pay on interest, even on the 2-year. So the question in the money market manager's mind is, where do I park this money? Fed is going to reduce their interest payments. Treasury's going to reduce their interest payments. 2-year, 5-year, 10-year. General trending is downward for Treasury. Where's the safe haven with a reasonable rate of return? Well, right now, it appears to be the stock market. That's an oxymoron if you're saying safe haven in the stock market, because that certainly there is no faith, full faith and credit scenario with the stock market. But this is where money starts going, because it's yield driven. It's greed driven. So I want to go to tonight's scripture, 1 Corinthians chapter 2. Kind of take a pause from this technical discussion. I'll read all of the chapter, but I want to start at verse 6 of chapter 2 of 1 Corinthians. Among the mature, however, we speak a message of wisdom, but not the wisdom of this age or the rulers of this age, rulers, okay, who are coming to nothing. No, we speak of the mysterious and hidden wisdom of God, which he destined for our glory before time began. None of the rulers of this age understood it, for if they had, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory. Rather, as it is written, no eye has seen, no ear has heard, no heart has imagined what God has prepared for those who love him. But God has revealed it to us by the Spirit. The Spirit searches all things, even the deep things of God. For who among men knows the thoughts of man except his own spirit within him? So too, no one knows the thoughts of God except the Spirit of God. We have not received the spirit of the world, but the Spirit who is from God, that we may understand what God has freely given us. And this is what we speak, not in words taught us by human wisdom, but in words taught by the Spirit, expressing spiritual truths in spiritual words. The natural man does not accept the things that come from the Spirit of God, for they are foolishness to him, and he cannot understand them, because they are spiritually discerned. The spiritual man judges all things, but he himself is not subject to anyone's judgment. For who has known the mind of the Lord so as to instruct him? But we have the mind of Christ. I'll go back to verse 1. When I came to you, brothers, I did not come with eloquence or wisdom as I proclaimed to you the testimony about God. For I resolved to know nothing while I was with you, except Jesus Christ and him crucified. I came to you in weakness and fear and with much trembling. My message and my preaching were words of wisdom, but with a demonstration of the Spirit's power, so that your faith would not rest on men's wisdom, but on God's power. Now, I share that with you because what we've described here tonight so far, I would call the folly of man, the complete lack of wisdom by man. To have created from the beginning of the economic system that we're burdened with now, to create it in a debt-based manner, that speaks of the spirit of greed. There's no need, if you are not driven by greed, there's no need for a debt-based system. There's no need to charge interest. There's no need for usury. Interest rates, 30% on credit cards and things like that, subprime loans. There's no reason for that, except by the false wisdom of man, driven by greed, thinking that, oh, they know better. They can get rich. They can get rich on the backs of their fellow man. So now we're in a situation here where the U.S. government is insolvent, and I'm going to share from my notes here in a moment, but just right up front, U.S. government as a sovereign nation is on the brink of insolvency, default. This debt-based system cannot continue much longer. We've talked at length about derivatives. Well, that balloon is blowing up right now. So I want to just kind of take a little sidetrack into derivatives for just a second. We know that the debt-based economy has generated quadrillions, probably anywhere from 1 to 4 quadrillion in derivatives. We understand that these are debt instruments, paper, if you will, that derive their value from an underlying asset. That asset, let's say it's a piece of real estate, then is hypothecated, to use an economic term, specifically a banking term, hypothecated. In other words, it is used as collateral not only for the first loan on that real estate, assuming that the real estate is fully owned by the borrower who's putting that real estate up for collateral. Let's say it's 10 acres of land. It has a market value. Based on that market value, a percentage of, let's say it's 75% of market value, can be used in as collateral against a loan. What that means is the first person to borrow money using that land as collateral, the 10 acres, is placing the bank that they borrowed that money from in first position. And most of you know what that means, but first position is that again, I apologize for the interruptions. Should the borrower default on that loan, the bank then takes the collateral, which is that land, and the bank will then sell that land to recoup what it lost from that borrower defaulting on that loan. There can then, in the hypothecation cycle, that bank could sell your loan to another bank, to another private investor, could put it out in the marketplace. So that second buyer of that first loan is now in second position. It's kind of like a first mortgage and a second mortgage on one house. The second mortgage is held by a bank. Should the homeowner default on the mortgage, the property is sold off and the proceeds go first to satisfy the first position bank. And if there are any monies left beyond what is owed to the first position, then that second mortgage and that second position bank will then get some of the proceeds. Some of the proceeds from the sale of that property. Now, this is a derivative scenario, but derivatives go out multiples into the hundreds of hypothecated positions. And this is what results in the quadrillions of derivatives, because somebody buys, and somebody buys, and somebody buys, and they get further and further from the collateral. What's happening right now is this domino effect of defaults. The first position defaulting. So let's use the mortgage. Forget about the real estate. Let's use the mortgage on the house because we can, most of us relate to this. The first position homeowner, borrower, goes into foreclosure. That triggers all these second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh positions that all want their position satisfied. They want to be repaid. Okay? So just as I said, as a tangent, derivatives right now are beginning to collapse. This is an early warning indicator, okay, for the collapse of the global economy. We said this 2 years ago. All right. More on the what's relevant to you and I front. With banks no longer able to borrow money from the Federal Reserve through the Bank Term Funding Program, which ended today, and very little money left in the reverse repo program from the Fed, $450 billion sounds like a lot to you and I, but it's really nothing in the banking system. So by late May, early June, that's going to go away. So this creates this liquidity crisis, and that translates for you and I into no loans, auto and home loans, no credit card issuance, existing credit card interest rates going up. As I mentioned, no ability for businesses to borrow money on their orders and so forth. And then mortgage-backed securities, MBSs. You'll recall that discussion from The Great Financial Crisis, 2008-2009, mortgage-backed securities. What got most of the attention back then was the subprime market collapse, meaning those with little to no credit borrowing at 100 to 125% of the home's sale price as a loan at high interest rates with poor credit, suddenly found themselves in a situation where they could not service the loan. They couldn't make their mortgage payments. When those mortgage payments were not coming in, that put at risk the securities that were hypothecated from those mortgages. So a security, a note, is collateralized, it's backed by the mortgage that a person is making payments on. The bank hypothecated the first mortgage and wrote another note and put it out in the marketplace and said, buy this new note that is collateralized by the mortgage payment on this house. This is why I was reading from the Federal Reserve at the beginning that, you know, this is a fairy tale. This is all a fairy tale. You and I, we could never do what the banks do. We could not create something out of nothing and say it has value and then trick people into buying it and say that it's secured by another loan being paid by some a loan that is being paid by somebody other than me who is selling this new piece of paper to you. It's like the shell game. And this goes on and goes on and goes on. Well, those mortgage-backed securities are collapsing right now, as I speak. So it's not just the BTFP ending today that is sort of this, you know, if we have to go there, the Chicken Little scenario, there are a lot of reasons for the sky to fall, okay? The banks, during the course of the BTFP program, borrowed $160 billion. $160 billion. And it was for a one-year term. It's like term life insurance, okay? Bank term funding program for 1 year. They could borrow that money. So, where was the collateral for borrowing this money? Here's an interesting little scenario. I'm trying to pull my notes together, summarize them here. So we talked about the mortgage, and then we talk about mortgage-backed securities that are collateralized by the first mortgage, which is collateralized by the home and the real estate that it sits on. Well, if banks are going to the Federal Reserve under BTFP, what are they using for collateral to borrow this $160 billion since the program began? And by the way, just in the last 4 to 6 weeks, the chart on the borrowing of money by the banks has gone completely parabolically vertical, as the expiration date today drew closer. They accelerated their borrowing. Well, they put up assets. Here's what the Federal Reserve did to make it attractive to the banks. It said, we understand you're insolvent. I'm sort of speaking as Jerome Powell right now, saying to the local banker, we know you're insolvent. We'll keep you afloat with this program. But we need some collateral. But we'll make it a really sweet deal for you. We understand that your collateral will be in the form of your assets. We know that your assets are experiencing rapid decline in their value. And we understand that that is translating to increased unrealized losses on your banks. This is Powell talking to the Now, rather than those assets just dwindle away in value sitting on your books, transfer those assets to the Federal Reserve's books. We will buy them at par. In other words, what you paid for that asset originally, we'll give you that. We'll give you par, full market value. Even though it's declined 25%, 50%, 25%, in market value, your assets are just dwindling down to zero. We'll give you 100% on that asset. We'll take it on our books. These are known as toxic assets by the Fed. Because the banks know that they're declining in value, so they're not going to be able to sell them except at a huge discount to some potential buyer. So they're stuck with assets that are toxic. The Fed makes a sweet deal and says, we'll buy all your toxic assets at 100% at par value. We'll hold them as assets, as collateral. And you can borrow that par value, that 100% value of that asset. You can borrow against that asset. Your own asset, put up as collateral, you can borrow on that. So the banks say, this is a sweet deal. We can keep our doors open for a year. Maybe somehow, some way, things will get better in that year time frame. Maybe the Fed will have another program in a year. Okay, so now it's March 11th. The banks have to pay the piper, have to pay the Fed. And the Fed says, you have to pay back every penny that you borrowed. You borrowed against an asset that we said 100% par value you can borrow against, but you have to pay all that back. I know you're jumping ahead, so let's jump ahead together. The question is, will the Fed come to the rescue with another program? Possibly. Remember, we're at 144,000 feet on Patch Airlines. We're looking at the big picture. Is there a motivation? Is there a agenda? For the Fed to bail out the banks? Well, if you've been following what I've been saying for a couple of years, there's no motivation on the part of the Fed to bail out the banks beyond today. Doesn't mean tomorrow banks are going to close their doors, but here's the situation. As far as I can tell, there's not going to be a replacement program for BTFP. There's not going to be another. The reverse repo program down to $450 billion and will be gone, will be empty by late May, early June. There's no indication that money market managers or the like are going to bring investment money to the Fed for the reverse repo program, because the interest rates are slated to come down by the Fed. Therefore, the reverse repo yield, the interest payments, do not appear to be attractive enough for money to come in to reverse repo. So that program, we're going to say, is going to be that program as well is going to be dead. So the banks are sitting here and they're in a no-win situation. No source of cash flow, liquidity, nothing on the horizon. They're already insolvent. Their assets are now being held by the Fed, so they don't have any assets. And way back in March of 2020, the Fed said, you don't have to have any reserves. So the banks are sitting there with no reserves. Now, they knew this was going to happen. This isn't happening in a vacuum in the banking world. The obvious solution, we said earlier, and we've said for many, many months, this is consolidation of the banking industry. We will begin, and probably in another month or so, we will see the first of many regional banks that will be absorbed into the larger banks. The 144,000-foot perspective is banking consolidation. That means there's greater control by the central banks, United States, European, Chinese, so forth. Okay? That's what they want from big picture. Consolidate everything. Therefore, you can control everything. Whether you're talking about banking, the economy at large, natural resources, the population, the biology of the population, it's all about consolidation, what I like to call coalescence of everything for maximum surveillance, command, and control. That's the big picture summary. So there is no on the horizon bailout for the banking system. This is going to trigger the stock market to collapse. This is going to lead to massive layoffs, unemployment. So as one of the leading indicators that you can pay attention to is the unemployment rate. A subcategory of the unemployment rate is the number of hours worked. Okay, so payroll hours. You can have a reduction in payroll hours without laying someone off, but you can only go so far with that. So as we see the numbers, the payroll hours begin to decline, that's an early indicator. Then as we see the actual job loss numbers, that's an even bigger early indicator. It's an early indicator of a stock market collapse, which of course is an economic collapse. And that rolls out to the rest of the world. This is bigger due to the size of debt that we're talking about by all the players. The size of the debt by all the players is so much larger than it was with the great financial crisis of 08 and 09, that's just a blip on the radar compared to what we're facing now. Again, when people prognosticate and say things like, well, you know, in 2025, we'll see a collapse. I don't hold to that. For the reasons I've outlined already, I don't hold to, yeah, things will be okay until 2025 and then it'll collapse. No. So let's dig into more of the bad news. Let's take a step back just a little bit historically. Why was the bank term funding program even devised and offered from a bigger perspective, let's say bigger than the consolidation of the small into the larger banks, which is an obvious mechanism of having a short-term lending program that then ended today. Let's get a little bit bigger perspective on it. You remember what the Fed is? You remember what the Fed has been threatening now for a couple of years? The central bank digital currency? This ushers in the CBDC. You have people with their reaction peaking in our problem reaction solution scenario, the Hegelian dialect. They're peaking in their reaction based on fear, a lack of available credit, losing their jobs, unemployment, losing their homes, not able to pay for rent, all of these things, peaking reaction. At the same time, right now, the US dollar is plummeting in value. We don't even need to talk about the bond market. You all know about that. Inverted yield curve, divesting by countries of their holdings of treasury bonds and the like, and no one available to buy those bonds. So the reaction is being peaked. So a solution is then presented in the form of a digital currency. You see, there's this flight to gold that's been going on and flight to silver. You've had all these people out there saying, you know, the dollar is worthless. Gold and silver always have value in any economy, in any type of economy. Gold and silver always has a value to it. We know from scripture that they'll be casting their silver, their coins into the streets because they're worthless. But people view precious metals as a safe haven in a declining sovereign currency environment. But that's not really the answer. Few people can afford to buy precious metals. The thing that is not appreciated in those markets is that there are more certificates for gold and silver that are issued in lieu of holding the physical metal. There's less physical metal than the quantity that is represented in the form of paper certificates for the physical. Physical gold and silver has been hypothecated. It's been oversold into these certificates, and people don't realize that. So that's not the answer. And this will come out. This will collapse the gold and silver markets when this comes out. Who's going to reveal it? The Federal Reserve. Central banks around the world, including the US Federal Reserve, have been buying physical gold and silver like crazy, especially gold. We've talked about BRICS and all of that, but that includes our own Federal Reserve buying gold. Because they want to collapse the foundation, the basic building blocks of the economy, of the monetary system. Remember, it's minted coins, printed sovereign currency, and Federal Reserve issued credit. You take away the coins, you take away the printed sovereign currency, the sovereign notes, all you're left with is federal credit as one of your building blocks for your monetary system. So now with just the Fed being the last player, they bring in their currency, which is the central bank digital currency, and say, look, problems. Problems in the multiple solved by the digital currency. You won't have money laundering. You won't have autonomous purchases. You won't have a devaluing dollar. Will stabilize the value and will back it by precious metals, primarily gold. Again, this is the narrative from the BRICS nations, but from the Federal Reserve as well. And people will demand that digital currency. The flip side to that coin is surveillance, command, and control. So this is the bigger picture as to why the Bank Term Funding Program was short-term for the purposes of fully implementing the central bank digital currency. They needed time. Remember, we were talking about in early 2023 that we expected by the end of 2023 that the reset would happen. Well, it didn't, because they needed time to set up the central bank digital currencies with all of the world's central banks. So they put in a stopgap lending program, the BTFP, to buy enough time for the central bank digital currency to be fully rolled out, fully readied. So they're creating a crisis, but dragging it out for a year, and then the crisis hits. The small banks get absorbed by the bigger banks. Liquidity evaporates. Credit evaporates. We peak the reaction. And then they roll out the central bank digital currency. Now, the question is, at this point in our step-by-step scenario, will the CBDC be rolled out as the solution prior to the reset or post-reset? I'm still banking, purposeful pun, I'm still banking that the reset will happen first, the global economic collapse, and then bringing in the central bank digital currency as the solution. Because remember, they have to get people to demand the solution. Financially, the solution they're offering is digital. Biologically, the solution they're offering is the final solution vaccine through the microneedle array patch. And there are several others that are going to be offered as solutions, okay, political and environmental. So what we need to understand is that, yes, it's all a setup. Give me just a second here. You know, I'm going to go back to my notes here for a second. We were talking about the BTFP and the assets. So the Fed bought the assets at par market value from the banks, and then allowed the banks to borrow up to that par value. Well, at the end of that 1 year, the Federal Reserve will give back those assets to the banks. But here's how criminal the Federal Reserve is. They say on the one hand, go ahead and borrow at fair market value on the assets, toxic assets that we purchase from you and put on our books as collateral. The evil side of this is when the Fed returns those toxic assets to the banks, which they're beginning as of tomorrow, it won't be at par value. It won't be at market value. It will be at less. It will be at less than the value when the banks gave that asset to the Fed. Let's put some numbers to it to make it relevant. My $100 scenario. So the bank originally, way back, they bought an asset for $100, par value. For whatever market condition reasons, it dropped to $80. Okay? So the Fed comes in and says, we'll give you $100 for what is at par value today at $80. So there's a $20 difference. The banks are going, great. And then the Fed says, you can borrow at that $100 for, for a year. And the banks go, great. Okay? Now we're at the end of the program. The banks have to pay up. They got to pay all of it. Starting tomorrow, they got to pay all that money back. And the Fed, what are they going to do with those toxic assets? They bought them at par value, $100, something at the time that was only worth $80. Now the Fed is going to return that asset, and let's just put a number to it, but it's only going to be worth $60. So it goes from $100 to $80 to $60. They get it back at $60, something that when they gave it to the Fed as collateral, was worth $80. And the Fed said, we're not going to pay you $80, but we'll assume that it's worth $100, and you can borrow up to that $100. So now the double whammy to the banks is, you're getting something that's $20 less than when you gave it to the Fed. Plus, you have to pay back at that $100 level, because you borrowed that $100. I would not want to be the president of a bank and have to explain that, not only to the board of directors, but to shareholders, if they have shares, private shares or public shares, shareholders and depositors. Because from a mathematical standpoint, that's suicide. Exactly. Suicide for the bank. So this is why I'm saying the banks are going to have to consolidate. It's inevitable. It's irreversible. There is no other solution. So let's continue looking at the assets that are now, for the sake of discussion, only worth $60. There's a $40 gap. They bought it at $100, and when they got it back from the Fed, it's only worth $60. A $40 gap. That's called an unrealized loss. So now the bank says, well, at least we got $60. And somehow we got to pay the Fed back all the way to $100. Let's try and sell the asset. Okay. It's toxic. So you... It's a toxic asset. It's only worth $60. So you discount it to $40 to make it attractive to a potential buyer. Okay, you sell it at $40. Now you have a difference of $60 between $40 and $100. That's your unrealized debt. The moment you sold it, you now realize on your books a $60 loss. I'm giving you all this deep in the weeds kind of details. in the hope that I'm not boring you to tears, but to give you, as we try so hard here, to get down into the nuts and bolts, to get down to what's really going on in the machine, so that you walk away with some sense, just a general sense, of not so much the complexity, although you walk away understanding it's complex, but you walk away with the understanding that this is not a wise thing for man to be doing. This from the outset of the debt-based economic system was doomed to fail. It was set up for this failure that we're talking about right now. And every year it's only gotten worse. The more programs that are devised, the more bailouts, the more manipulation of interest rates, all these bubbles, whether you're talking real estate bubble, credit bubble, mortgage-backed security bubbles, inflationary bubble, deflationary bubbles, a system built on bubbles. That's where we're at. That's what we're walking away with, the understanding that the system is full of bubbles, full of hot air, and it's all bursting. Let's talk about corporate finances. We kind of did the real estate thing there for a little bit. Corporate finances, the corporations have the ability to enter into long-term financial agreements. So we can say 7-year, 10-year, and the like. And with those long-term loans, they can ride through these increases in interest rates and decreases, inflationary, deflationary periods, strong stock market, weak stock market. With longer-term loans, you're able to ride out the peaks and valleys of the economy. Well, the problem now is the majority of those corporate loans are due to roll over. We talked about this in 2023 with the derivatives. And that has now manifest early this year. We're in the first quarter. That most of these corporations are finding that they can no longer roll over. They cannot refinance their debt. Why is that? Well, because the Fed's interest rate is 5.25. So corporations are putting the pressure on the Fed to lower interest rates so they can afford to roll over into a new loan with long terms rather than having to pay back that loan. Sounds like the banks, doesn't it? One of the principal requirements for a lender is to look at a potential borrower's ability to service those loan payments, to be able to make the monthly payments. Corporations with long-term loans have enjoyed low interest rates, 1%, 2%, 3%. Now they're having to refinance in a market environment, a high interest environment, that they may not be able to make up the difference. Let's say they have a 3% loan. Now they're stepping into not just prime, but they're looking at 7%, 8%. That difference of, let's say, 5% interest, they cannot afford to service. They can't make the payments at that higher interest rate. So now what's their alternative? If they cannot refinance their debt, they cannot repay the principal that they borrowed, and they're left with default. What's the ripple effect of that? What's the ripple effect of that in the economy? That's why I'm saying pay attention to the cutting of hourly hours, the number of hours worked, worker hours, and look at the unemployment rate that trails behind that. Those are the early indicators that corporations are not able to refinance their debt. They cannot afford to service the debt, and they're going to default, which means they're going into bankruptcy. Okay? Now, you understand that scenario, pick that up and place it on the backs of the U.S. government. The U.S. government right now, I think the figure was every 100 days, has to make a $1 trillion payment. And they don't make it at the 100th day. Over the course of 100 days, the U.S. government must service its debt, the yield on the Treasury notes, the yield, $1 trillion. And that's about to double to $2 trillion. Now we get into the discussion of compounding interest. This is leading to default, sovereign debt default on the part of the United States. It could very well happen this year. There are already projections in terms of unfunded liabilities, unfunded programs. Social Security and Medicaid are unfunded. They're only paid for with new debt in the form of Treasury notes that are sold. There's no money coming in through tax revenue, no money coming in to pay for Medicaid and Social Security. That has to be paid for year to year through the sale of Treasury notes, more debt. And that debt has to be serviced. I'm looking for a figure here. I try to be as accurate. Looking for a GDP figure that I had here. Sorry for the delay, it just... Right now, corporate debt that I was just mentioning, of the gross domestic product of the United States, corporate debt represents 49%, nearly half of the gross domestic product of the United States. That's how much debt is on the books, how much is on the line, that cannot be refinanced, that cannot be rolled over. This is all part of that debit, that derivative roll, that derivative debt rollover scenario that we talked about all last year. Nearly half of the GDP is represented in corporate debt. So, government debt, I want to get back to that. Obviously, the United States is really has passed the point of no return. There is no mechanism available to pay back and to continue servicing the ever-increasing debt. Here's the insidious part of it. In order to service the debt, the government sells treasury notes and the bonds. There are really no buyers for bonds. So Treasury has to keep raising the yield to make them attractive to somebody. Well, you know who has been by Federal Reserve monetary policy? The banks have been required to purchase in the open market any unsold treasury notes. You have countries that are divesting in their treasury notes, flooding the market. You have institutional buyers like money market managers saying, nope, the yield is not high enough. And they're not clueless about the risk of default, sovereign debt default on the part of the government. So they're looking for safe havens and they're not finding it in treasury notes. So the banks get stuck buying, by Fed policy, buying these worthless treasury notes. Okay, so the banks are stuck with this. These are toxic assets. Bank term funding program, those worthless T-bills are put up as collateral, and then we roll on through that scenario. Okay? Well, the banks are holding these for the time being, let's say. They're holding these worthless treasury notes. The government is obligated to pay the yield, to pay the interest to those banks. So the banks are receiving interest. That's okay for the banks. The problem is over here with the government having to pay that interest to the banks. How does the government do that? Where does the money come from to make those interest payments, to service the debt? The insidious part is they sell more treasury notes to make the interest payments. It's as if they're trying to play catch up all the time. Let's just, for the sake of discussion, say on the 31st of every month, the government has to pay the banks and all the other holders of treasury notes their interest payment. Let's just say it's due on the 31st of the month. So leading up to all the course of that month, all the way up to the 31st, Treasury's trying to sell as many treasury notes as it can in order to have the cash on the 31st to make the interest payment. They generate more debt to pay on the debt. And with the sale of those new T-bills, there are new interest payments to new holders of those treasury notes that they have to pay interest on. So where does the money come from? Creating yet more treasury notes that they then have to, at a discount, find somebody to buy, and then they make the interest payment on the 31st, or arbitrary date, okay? This has been going on since 1971. Nixon, then President Nixon, took us off the gold standard, which meant that the U.S. government could spend more, they could participate in deficit spending, they could run up a debt and pay for it with treasury notes. I wish it were just a fairy tale. I wish it was only a fable. But it isn't. This is the reality we find ourselves in. We didn't create it. We didn't vote for it. We were born into it. We've been enslaved to it. Thank God and thank the Lord that He is going to cut short the days and He is going to put an end to all of this nonsense. All right. Almost done. We're almost done, and I apologize for all of these interruptions. This has never happened on our live streams since we've gone over to the Rumble platform. It's never happened before, so Doug and I'll sort it out before tomorrow night's live stream. Just making sure I've gone through all my notes here. In case you hadn't heard it already, the delinquency rates for auto loans, credit cards, home loans, that delinquency rate is skyrocketing. So the ability for the average person to pay their debts, they're falling behind. And as people are unable to pay their mortgages, pay their property taxes, pay on their credit cards and vehicle loans, that just has the ripple effect all the way through the economy. As I said at the beginning, there is more debt across the board than there was with the great financial crisis of 08 and 09. The only solution, and it's the only solution, and it's not a real solution, is the reset. It's been planned that way. The reset is the precursor to setting up the Antichrist. Whether that's a physical person or just a system, a beast system. You know, we have said we think it is going to be more of a beast system with a holographic image of an Antichrist than it is going to be an actual person. But I'm not dogmatic about that. It just seems that that's the direction it's going. We'll see. We'll see how this works out. But that isn't worth debating over. That isn't worth arguing over. The reset is to establish the one world government, one world currency, which is a cryptocurrency, and a one world leader, a one world economic system. One of my notes here is regarding gold. And I made my comment about that, and then we're going to wrap up. The other part about gold is that the more that people, I hate to even call it investing, I'll call it speculate by buying gold. The more demand for gold is a revelation. It's an indicator. It's showing the corruption of the economic system. What I mean by that is, if people do not have full faith in the U.S. government or any government to make good on its debts, because it's not just the U.S. that finances its deficit spending. If people lose faith in their governments to make good on their debts, if they don't trust the banking system, if they see their sovereign currency on a global basis, the dollar and otherwise, collapsing, if they see interest rates going up, if they see inflation continuing to go up, if they see unemployment numbers going up, then they're looking for a safe haven, and they think that gold or precious metals in general are a safe haven. Now, I'm not giving financial advice. I wouldn't buy gold. I wouldn't buy silver. That's just me. Okay? You do what you want to do, what you choose to do. But I'm talking really just rhetorically on a global basis. When we see this fleeing to gold or silver, it's an indication of a loss of faith in the system. Gold is viewed as standing apart from the system, that it has an inherent and endemic value to it. Well, that may be true and may not be true. Biblically, it's not true. Gold is just a metal. It's just a rock. It has no value. Same thing with diamonds. They have no value. In God's economy, they have zero value. It's the lack of wisdom on the part of man, as we see in 1 Corinthians chapter 2, the lack of wisdom. Their wisdom is putting their faith in man, in man's systems, rather than putting their faith in God and in salvation through Jesus Christ. That's the wisdom. That's where the faith is placed. But again, I'm giving you an economic indicator. It reveals the corruption in the debt-based system when people flee to gold and silver. Now, I didn't mention Bitcoin. Bitcoin, I think, is up around $69,000 now. Remember I said months ago when we were waiting for the ETF, the exchange-traded funds for Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies to be approved by the Securities and Exchange Commission of the United States, and that there would be this giant sucking sound in the liquidation of assets to be converted to Bitcoin, either the coin itself or the exchange-traded fund, which is treated like a mutual fund on the stock market. Well, that has been going on. Massive liquidation of assets going into Bitcoin, and that's what's driving its value up, is exactly what we said would happen. So it has happened the way that we stated it would. I'm not pontificating. I'm just saying, you know, it's pretty much logic playing out. Now, we reported about a week ago the sale of stock on the part of Amazon's Jeff Bezos, Bill Gates, and Microsoft, and the like. Millions and millions of dollars, millions and millions of dollars of shares of stock being sold off by these corporate leaders. And pretty much they're all doing it at the same time. And I said over a week ago that this is a leading indicator that things are about to change, that they were selling at the peak in the market. And they knew that March 11th was coming up today. They know about the ending of the reverse repo program in late May, early. They understand that the consolidation of the regional banks into the larger banks is going to have huge implications for the stock market and for people in general, and that this is going to lead to a loss of liquidity and a credit crisis. They know this. They're part of the instruments. They are the group of instruments that have created this scenario. So they're not reacting to it as much as they are anticipating the collapse. So they're getting out while the getting's good. Another leading indicator for us to pay attention to. All right, so again, I want to wrap up a couple of minutes early. I apologize for all these interruptions. We'll get down to the nuts and bolts of it, Doug and myself, and we'll get this rectified before tomorrow's live stream. Thank you for your patience tonight. Thank you for allowing us to postpone until tonight. And I hope this wasn't boring or overly technical. I'm really just trying to give you a sense of what's going on so that you're not caught unawares. So God bless you and good night.